Vera Gola of the Maharal is a remarkable sefer. Its goal is, as he wrote in the subtitle to this work, Perush al Mamorim Asher Aleihem Bo Hashela Mibnei Adam. It's a commentary on the Mamorim, on the statements of Chazal that people asked. People had questions about Asher Lo Yardu LaOmek HaMetzula, that did not succeed in going down to the depths. Omek HaMetzula is like the depths of the waters, you know, below, the real depths of what it means. And so the Maharal says, poetically, he calls this the Be'er, the well, that something where there's very, very deep meanings, that it's very much, you know, if you look at the surface, you don't see anything, but you have to draw out from the depths to be able to understand it, explain, tshufim u'mezukokim shivasayim, explained and purified seven times, to make it very, very bright and very, very enriching. That's the goal. And he says seven times clarified because there are seven sections, seven be'eros, seven wells that he, so to speak, refers to here in the Be'er HaGola. Basically, as we're going to see, he's here to be able to give greater appreciation to the statements of Chazal, the statements of the sages as are found especially, you know, throughout the Gemara, throughout the Talmud itself, but as well through other bodies of rabbinic literature, through other bodies of Divrei Chazal. And as he organizes it, he really comes to address a whole number of attacks, seven different attacks, which you'll see, God willing, whether you have the text or not, I made some copy of some section of it. Different attacks about what they mean, are they really, does what they're saying make sense? Are they playing liberties with adding to the Torah or taking away things from the Torah? Are they taking liberties of interpretation as to what the Torah means? Do they know what they're talking about? Do their statements jive with science? Do their statements jive with logic? Kinds of questions which, in truth, while we may be too delicate, you know, to formulate them as a full-fledged attack on the words of Chazal, however, when we read a passage here or hear a passage here and there that we read in the Gemara and our sort of one eyebrow goes up and we say, you know, like, what's going on here? What are they saying? Now the Maharal is going to use an approach where he's going to articulate principles and ideas to explain it. But really, the magnificent thing which he does is that he does much, much more than just explain principles, but he applies. He'll use specific passages of Divrei Chazal, specific Chazalin, specific statements of Chazal here and there and everywhere, and he will say, let's learn this piece now, and let's try to understand it. Look at it at first glance, and you say, oh my gosh, give me a break. Let's look at it a little bit more closely, and then let's see what it's about. So really, that's the way we're going to learn together. We're going to do the principles, but what we're going to try to do is, as we get together for the shiur, is take one passage, one piece from the Gemara, according to the Maharal's explanation, following according to the order, the way he builds it up, but we won't necessarily cover, in order that we can be able to cover the span of the book, we won't necessarily analyze every piece of the Talmud that he analyzes. We're going to do a sampling of the thesis as it develops, of each piece of it as it develops. And today, we're going to study his Hakdama. We're going to study his introduction. Again, not inside by the text. I think there are, I see somebody has both the excellent updated version of the Hebrew, which is a three-volume work by Rabbi Hartman, as well as there's an English digest of it to some degree, I think, from Rabbi Adlerstein. Thank you, Avi. But in the introduction, he sets the tone. Please come sit down. You're going to make me nervous. there's lots of room over here.
Howard, can I ask a preliminary question?
Yes.
When we talk about statements of Chazal, who's Chazal? Are they the rabbis from a certain period of time, or is it statements everyone preceded the Maral? Who are Chazal?
Okay, very good question. And please, everybody, ask questions. And I'm not interested in a monologue. The Chazal that are referred to generally... Bring a chair. Sit down, please. The Chazal that are referred to generally are the sages of the period of the Mishnah and the Talmud. Of the Mishnah and the Talmud. So, you know, that would be from the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, you know, the latter part of the second temple, all the way through to, you know, a few hundred years following them. We usually will not refer to the Rishonim, to the early commentaries post-Talmudic, or even the Gaonim, as Chazal. Even though Chazal means, literally, it's an acronym for Chachameinu, our sages, our wise men, Zichronim Livrocha, may their memory be blessed. You could say that about the Chafetz Chaim, you know, who lived 100 years ago. He was one of our sages, and his memory should be blessed. But as a matter of convention, we say, when we speak about Chazal, we speak about statements from that period, which are found in the Mishnah, which are found in the Talmud, which are found in the Medrash, in various Midrashim. These are all what we would call the loose body of the words of Chazal, the words of our sages. Some of the statements of Chazal are found in more cryptic bodies. In the Talmud, the Agados, you have a wide range. Some of them are clear, like almost halachic statements, and some of them are agadaic statements, midrashic statements, and they're a little bit more difficult to get at. Okay. Now, for starters, okay, again, we're going to do the Hakdama, please. I'm sorry. Some of you could take, pass around. There are about 20 of them, so it should be more or less enough. At least somebody here is optimistic. Well born. Okay. The Gemara, the passage here, that is a passage from the Gemara in Erevin. And we're going to learn it. You know, we just completed Erevin in the Daf Yomi. Some people here may be studying the Daf Yomi, so you know what it's like when you just read through a statement like this. And you will read through it. And this is the exercise. This is the way, this is the bright, eye-opening experience of studying with the Maral especially, but in general, trying to study the words of Chazal closely. You look at a statement, sometimes it's like, oh my gosh, what is this supposed to mean? Sometimes it's not a problem. I know exactly what it means, but it seems like a little simple, or maybe it seems like a little bit redundant. I'm going to read through this passage. We have it in the original, and on the bottom, on the left side of the bottom, is in the translation. The part in the original which we're going to be focusing on is let's start at Aleph Reish at the end of the fourth line on the top. Amar Rav Yochanan. Rav Yochanan said, Rav Oshia Berebi Bedoro, Rav Oshia Beribi, this was the way he was known. Beribi means Rav Oshia the Great in a certain sense. It's an unusual terminology. In his generation, Krab Meir Bedoro. He was like Rabbi Meir in his generation. Marabi Meir Bedoro lo yochul chaver of lamad al sof dato. Just like Rav Meir in his generation, his contemporaries couldn't really understand him. He was very profound, and he was above the heads of his contemporaries, of his peers. Af Rav Oshia lo yochul chaver of lamad al sof dato. Rav Yochanan also, his peers couldn't really understand him so well. Which leads us now to the Gemara's comment of focus. That's an introductory line which tells you Rav Oshia Berebi, he was something. He was a very, very profound person. I'm Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says, this is not just, you know, there was one individual out there like this. Rabbi Yochanan says, Libon shel Rishonim kepischo shel Ulam. The hearts of the Rishonim were like the Pesach, like the opening of the Ulam. An ulam is a term for like a large banquet hall. However, over here, the Talmud is referring to something specific. When it came to the building of the temple, of the Beis HaMikdash, we know in the second Beis HaMikdash, I wish I would have prepared with a picture, it would have been worthwhile. But the second Beis HaMikdash, the building itself, you know, you have the Temple Mount, that whole area, that whole courtyard, the building itself was, if one faced it, like you're facing me, you would see something like this, something like a T. This part, the part, the book itself, was a tall building known as the Heichal, the hall. the main hall of the temple, inside which was found the menorah, the table for the showbreads, the golden altar for the incense. Deep inside it was the Holy of Holies, where the ark was found. That's the Eichel, that's the main building. In front of it, built onto it, was something called the Ulam, right? The top of the T was something called an Ulam, which was even taller and broader, and it was like an entranceway. It was kind of a foyer into the temple. And the foyer into the temple was very, very tall, and its entrance was very, very tall. How tall was the entrance? It was 20 amos, 20 cubits, right? Or more, whatever it was. And it was 20 cubits, wide of it, you know, the entrance. It was very, very broad opening. The Heichal, the building itself, had a more narrow opening, 10 amos wide. So we say, the hearts of the Rishonim, they were kepischo shel ulam. They were open like the opening of the ulam, of that big, big entranceway. Shel achronim, of the later ones, kepischo shel heichal. Their openings, their hearts were open like the opening of a heichal, of the regular building. In other words, a more modest size. What does it mean that their hearts were open? Anybody? What do you think?
Their understanding,
their wisdom. Their wisdom of the first ones were huge. The wisdom of the later ones was a little bit more narrow. V'anan and us, what about us? Kimole nekev machat sidkis. Ours is like the pinhole, like the eye of a needle. That's how machat sidkis is a very fine needle for fine tailoring. So the finer the needle, the smaller the eye. Our hearts are so open, they're open like the eye of a needle. Right now, that is encouraging and inspiring. Take the rest of the day off. So, their hearts were wide open like a huge, huge thing. The next generation, the later ones, narrower. Ours, like a little tiny thing. Okay. Rishonim, who were the first ones? Rabbi Akiva. Achronim, Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. The later ones, so the Talmud gives us two different generations of students to identify. What's the period of the Rishonim? What's the period of the Achronim? Some of you are familiar with the terms. We use the term Rishonim and Achronim. I just used it to you before. Right? What are the Rishonim? So we say the Rishonim are the commentaries post the Talmudic, post the Gaonic period. Like Rashi is called a Rishon. The Rambam is called a Rishon. When does that period end? Right, so there's a big debate as exactly what's the cutoff. When do we say the period of the Rishonim ends? You know, usually some people say that, you know, anybody who's brought by the Beis Yosef, right, is going to be considered amongst the Rishonim. Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, 1500s. You know, and then we have the period of the Achronim, the later ones. Some say that has stopped too. When did that end? Who was the last of the Achronim? Right? It's hard to define the periods. The Talmud here, however, is speaking about periods which are pre-Talmudic and referring to them as Rishonim, early ones and later ones. What are those eras? So it defines them by landmark personalities. Ikud Yamri, others say Rishonim, Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, Achronim, Rabbi Yoshia Berebi. The Rishonim, Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, the last ones were that Rabbi Yoshia Berebi, who we just mentioned before. V'onu kemole machat sidkis. But we, right, forget them, we are like a little pinhole. But if the Gemara hasn't said enough, Amar Abaye says, Va'anan, and us, ki sichsa beguda l'gemara. We're like a peg in a wall, a nail that gets driven into a wall for Gemara, for our learning. Amar Rava says, Va'anan, and us, Rava was a little bit later, he was a contemporary of Abaye, but a little bit considered on later, ki etzba'asa bekira l'svara, like a finger stuck in wax, pressed into wax, right? Not like a nail into the wall for our learning, but like a finger placed in wax, in hard wax, for svara, for logic. Amar Ravashi, and Ravashi said, now both of those, you get the sense that it's a little tough, right? There's not even a hole there until you push in the nail. It's not even the eye of a needle. There's not even a hole there until you push in the nail. And you have to push in the nail in order to get something in. With the wax, is there even a hole? What's the What's that mean? What's the difference between a nail in a wall and a finger in wax? Okay, here's where we go from saying, oh, okay, you know, this one's like that, like, well, it sounds a little simplistic, they're just trying to, you know, it's just a good put-down line, you know, your head is like a little eye of a needle. Right, you know, like, well, what's happening here? Too, like, enigmatic. What's someone saying? Oh, a peg in a wall, a finger in the wax, like, what's that about?
The wall. What just stays in the
just
wall.
Stays on top. Okay, lisvara. But he says, not for Gemara. Gemara, which is learned knowledge from somebody else. Svara is for logic. And I'm Rav Ashi, and Rav Ashi said, to top it off, anan ki etz be'isa bebira l'shikha. When it comes to forgetting, we are the experts. When it comes to forgetting, we are like when you put a finger into a well. Okay, now that's really tough, right? Putting a finger into a well, you know, pulling it out, you know, like that's really tough. You get big scars on the edges around your finger when you try to get it into a well, right? Putting a finger into a well is nothing, right? Putting a big boulder into a well, you know, maybe it fits right. Finger just goes, you know, in and out, no problem. We have that power, the power of being able to forget. Thank you very much. Okay, so that's it. That's the passage which we have here in the Gemara. Okay, an innocent passage in Eruvin. And what do we do with it? What does it mean? What do we take it? Clearly, what they're saying is that there's a difference between our generation and earlier generations, between the earlier the later they get, things have changed. So this is a passage which we're going to now, Be'ezras Hashem, try to analyze and study closely with the help of the Maharal. But this is the passage that the Maharal uses as his central text for his introduction. And let me explain to you, basically, quickly, what the idea is of the introduction and what's going to frame all of our study, Be'ezras Hashem, with Hashem's help, of this subject together. The Rambam also wrote a passage about having our attitude towards these words of Chazal. And I'm going to borrow from the Rambam's teaching of this. It's very, very usable here in the context of this discussion.
Excuse me, Rabbi. When is the Maharal? When did the Maharal live?
Maharal lived in the 16s, right?
So in other words, he's an Acharon.
I think, right? Am I correct? Or 7th? 15s, huh? Late 15s. Okay.
So is he a Rishon?
No, the Maharal is considered an Acharon, for sure. Early Acharon. But the Maharal is one of these seminal figures of Jewish learning that, you know, changed the landscape, that, you know, brought in a whole new way of thinking. Okay. So the Rambam writes like this. He says, you know, Chazal, our sages, say things, and he's dealing essentially with the same problem that I mentioned with the Maharal. People read what Chazal say, and they say, what on earth are they saying over here? Does this make sense? You know, is it right? People, Chazal will say all kinds of comments, and the Maharal says there are three categories of responses to the things which the sages say. Sages say something, and people can take it literally. So one person's going to listen to what Chazal say, and they're going to take it exactly literally. Every statement which they say, they're going to take at literal, at face value. And they'll say, Chazal said it, this is what they said, this is what they meant, and they'll swallow it completely, hook, line, and sinker. Rambam says, now that is not good. Why? Because Chazal, if you read something, and it sounds ridiculous, and it doesn't seem to be right, and it doesn't jive with logic, with the thinking of a wise person, the objective thinking of a wise person, so then, if you are just taking it and swallowing it whole, so you're going to be a person who will stand up and say, I know, I'm telling you, I represent the opinions of Chazal, and what you're going to be presenting is all of these very, very simplistic and sometimes ridiculous sounding ideas. Then there's another person, and that person listens to what Chazal say. They take it, this is what they said, and they say, you know something, this stuff is ridiculous. these guys obviously did not know what they were talking about. And the third group, which he says the Rambam is the smallest slice, will say Chazal knew what they were talking about. They were wise people. But they're saying this, and this doesn't make sense. So maybe I have to probe deeper to understand what they mean. I like to give the following example, the following metaphor to illustrate this. You're a shortwave nut, right? You know, you like doing, you're operating ham radios. And you have a group, a bunch of guys that get together and you operate these ham radios. And one day, one of the guys comes in and he says, you know, I just got from somebody the frequency for the CIA's central line on the shortwave. I say, great, tonight, this is going to be the night. They go, they spin the dials, they come to the frequency, and sure enough, a voice crackles through, and it says, go immediately to the supermarket and buy purple tomatoes. Now, there are three people who are sitting there around the shortwave, so one of them rushes to the front closet, gets his coat, runs outside in the rain to the first supermarket, walks into the supermarket and says, please, please, sell me some purple tomatoes. And the guy in the store looks at him like the nut, which he is. The second guy says, I can't believe it. You know, I never thought that all those right-wing talk radio people were right. But government is really insane. Look at these guys. This is the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States. And what do they have? What do they sit and they talk about? All they're doing is talking about going to the store and buying purple tomatoes. These guys are really ridiculous nuts. My taxpayer dollars, they're all going down the drain. I've said it from the beginning. Now I know that it's really true. And the third guy says, hold on. This is the CIA. They're, you know, you may have some ethical questions about the CIA. You may have some moral questions about the CIA. But complete lunatics, complete idiots, they're not. They're serious. But on the other hand, go to the store and buy purple tomatoes. It must be that they're speaking in code. It must be that I'm not supposed to just take this statement and literally go to the store and buy purple tomatoes. There is no such thing as purple tomatoes. I mean, I'm sure one of these freaky stores has them. But you know, by and large, there was no such thing as purple tomatoes, and they have better things to talk about than what they're having for dinner. So it must be they are talking about something else. They are talking about more significant, and I have to plumb the depths of it to appreciate it, to understand it. In other words, instead of sitting on the high horse and saying, oh my gosh, these guys are crazy, these were clearly the sages and scholars of the Jewish people. And the Jewish people, whatever it is that they were accused of, it was one thing that they were not accused of was to be intellectual dwarfs. They were giants, they were greats. And the sages of the Talmud were giants and greats. And if they have something, if they say something, to just write it off and say, my gosh, this is ridiculous, this is childish, means that we are too busy thinking about how intelligent we are to not even give serious consideration to others who were known for their greatness and for their intelligence. Says the Maharal, the first thing that we have to know in our attitude towards Chazal is to understand that they were very deep, that they were very wise, that they were very profound. And if anything, vice versa. As this Talmudic passage shows us, or says to us, you know, they had a wisdom which we have to struggle to approach. And so when it comes time to learn the words of Chazal, we need to do it with that kind of humility, with that kind of understanding. Now, before we go to look exactly at this passage of the Gemara and to analyze that, we need to learn as well the piece which the Maharal teaches, which is, you know, the Maharal didn't only analyze words of Chazal. The Maharal also, in the process of doing so, dropped to us and shared with us insights that are nothing short of dramatic. And this is the way the Maharal starts. And those of you who want to follow along with it, it's on this paper, is with a very, very simple profundity. The Masha Shlemus HaAdam B'Yediyas Uva'asogas HaNimtzoyim Haya yosa rishona ladasu lahasig mahus atzmo v'lo yasachal ba'atzogas atzmo. A person wants to learn and wants to know things. So tell me something. What is the most basic thing and the closest to home that a person should try to know and to understand? Or that a person would know and understand? What should a person know best? Yourself. Right? You're with you all the time, right? You want to go and study something that's under a slide in a lab? That's very nice, but that's there. You'll go, you'll see it, you'll go there at 9 o'clock in the morning, you'll see it, maybe you'll hang around with it for 9, 10 hours, and then you're going to go home. And next week you're going to be studying something else. You live with yourself all the time. Sometimes we would like to escape, but we can't. So we should know ourselves best. Isn't that the way it should be, said the Maral? Uve emes hasoga zos lo kalohi. But he says, you know, this ain't easy. It's not easy to know yourself. Kilo rabim yechochmu bahasoga zos, hi asogas madregas atzmo. There aren't too many people who really, really understand themselves. Vim kalusa hi mitzad etzem hasoga zos, ki raf yiftach eino yimtza hu la'atzme, ki l'rocha kuv l'ba shamayim. In a certain sense, it's the easiest, because it's the most accessible, right? He's right there. He's there all the time. It's not in the heavens. It's not across the ocean. Ach rov ne'odem yasigu hasoga zos b'chiluf mashahu. But in truth, he says, most people don't really, really understand themselves. Most people, indeed, sometimes have an appreciation of themselves that's not accurate. They perhaps will say, you know, oh, the early sages, you know, they were wise, but, you know, we have the benefit of generations of accumulated knowledge, of greater sophistication, and so maybe we understand things better. This is his approach. And what the Maral goes on to say in another profound passage later on is, that for a person to really understand their strengths, what do they have to have a real understanding of? They have to understand what their weaknesses are, where they aren't so strong. When we understand our weaknesses, our blind spots, our vulnerabilities, in that framework, in that context, we'll be able to really, really understand our strengths. Maral does not want to, you know, and in truth, there's no reason to just make this, okay, here we're going to pound the people who are studying this book and tell them, you guys, you're a bunch of idiots. You don't understand anything. The sages knew, they knew what we're talking about. But that's a thing of the past. Maral says, no. All we need to do is to pierce whatever bubbles of illusion that we have about what we do and what we don't, what we understand and what we really don't yet understand. And then we'll have a good handle on where we are and where we stand, and then we'll really be able to do something. Then we'll really be able to delve. Then we're really going to be able to understand. So, says Maral, when a person takes this position, which is the position of deference relative to the words of Chazal, understanding that they have great wisdom, and it's wisdom which we may not just get with a snap of the fingers, that we have to maybe probe and study a little bit more to fully and properly appreciate, then we have the tools of learning. Yes?
This is kind of going back a little bit. Why is it that Chazal felt it necessary to encode what they said?
Okay, so that's a very good question. Why did Chazal encode? Why did they encrypt? So there are different reasons which are given. The Rambam says reasons, the Ramchal says reasons. But to a certain degree, the two reasons which are applicable are the following. One is that they generally encrypted and encoded those things which were more profound and sensitive information. Generally speaking, you will find that that's what they did. Just like the CIA, the CIA will encrypt what they have to say, but the Chais, you know, the Surgeon General is not going to encrypt his reports, right? Because he wants everybody to read them plainly. Something which is more privileged information is going to be hidden under greater layers. And generally, the worlds of philosophy were considered to be more privileged information. The halacha to tell you what you can do on Shabbos and you can't do on Shabbos, that the sages wanted to say in plain speak. But when it came to philosophical issues, there it was considered really the study of the more subtle, of the more profound, and therefore they didn't want to make it, you know, throw it out there as plainly as simply. And the other one is, and that's applicable, I think, especially in a passage like this one, is that they spoke in a way which drew people in. Right? When were people most listening to me in the past half hour? When I talked about the shortwave radio and the purple tomatoes. Right? Let's face it, guys. Right? When you speak in certain manners of when you'll speak in a certain way which is perhaps a little bit exaggerated, a little bit strange, that's the way you do it, right? The Talmud has a famous passage where it speaks about how Rabbi Akiva looked around and he saw the students falling asleep, right? See, happens. Happens to the best of them, right? So he looked around, he saw the students passing asleep. So he said, what is it that, why did Esther come and rule over 127 kingdoms as the queen of Ahasuerus? The granddaughter of the woman who lived 127 years, Sarah, should come and rule over 127 kingdoms. Now, that's a typical Midrashic statement. We say, hold on, what's going on? What does Sarah living 127 years have to do with Esther ruling over 127 kingdoms? Right, so that's a perfect medrash. But Rabbi Akiva said it. Right, there is a profound meaning to that, which someday, God willing, we could be able to study together. But the point is that he said it, and he said it in that way because he wanted people to latch onto it. He wanted people to wake up to it. And in a certain sense, when you present something like this, that the heart of the early ones was like the big, big entrance, you know, to a stadium, and the next one was like the entrance to a banquet hall, and ours is like the eye of a needle, right? That's a memorable statement. But it's also a profound statement. So now let's go to the passage in the Gemara, and let's see what it means. Yeah?
I just wanted to say, I think Maharal lived around 1560 to
1600. Okay, great. Thank you. I have a horrible heart.
I meant
late 16th century, yeah. And early 17th century, right. In keeping with the spirit of knowing your weaknesses, historical dates. Okay. The Gemara says like this. Again. We'll start with that statement. The hearts of the early ones were like the opening of the Ulam, and of the latter ones were like the opening of the Heichal. Rashi, in his comments, simple, straight, says the Ulam was 20 amos wide, the entrance, and the Heichal was 10 amos wide. So these were twice as wide. Is that where it begins? So this is the way the Maharal explains this passage. To start with an assumption. And the assumption is as follows. First of all, Libon Shel Rishonim, the hearts of the Rishonim. Where do you have intelligence? We imagine that our intelligence is in the brain. Right? We know it. Did the Talmud not know that intelligence was in the brain? Did David HaMelech, when he said the line that Alva Sudamna already just said, V'yodata hayom v'ashevosa elav avecha, you will know today v'ashevosa elav avecha, and you will bring it home to your heart. That Hashem is the Elohim, that Hashem is the God. He also didn't know about the brain, right? Wisdom is in the heart. What does it mean? It speaks about it all over the place. Ulevava yavin. His heart will understand, his heart will comprehend. Heart is a muscle that pumps blood. What does it speak about? That their wisdom was the width of the heart, the breadth of the heart. They knew about the brain. Everywhere in the Talmud, in so many places in the Talmud, it refers to the brain as well, obviously, a tool of intelligence and of knowledge. What does it mean? Chachmas Halev, the wisdom of the heart. So, I want to borrow from another passage of the Talmud. Also a famous passage which also describes a change in the generations. It's not in front of you. And in fact, the Maharal himself doesn't quote it here in this commentary. But it's a very worthwhile passage to bring as a parallel. The Talmud says, Im harishonim kimalochim, if the early ones were like angels, if we would consider the early ones like angels, anu kivnei adam, then we would have to consider ourselves like people. If the early ones were going to consider like people, then what would we consider ourselves like?
Stupid.
Chamorim. Donkeys.
Stupid.
Okay, so we've gone from pinholes to donkeys, right? So, what does that mean? And the Gemara goes on and say, not like the donkey of Rav Pinchas ben Yair, There was a Talmud says a story about the donkey of Pinchas ben Yair, who was a great sage, that that donkey was very, very wise. It didn't eat from any non-kosher food. Instinctively, when it crossed the river split for it. You know, not like that kind of donkey. We're talking about the donkey that you see at the petting zoo, right? That's what we're like. If the first ones were like people. Now, again, what is this saying? So, look at this structure. We have in this statement of Chazal three categories of being: angels, people, and animals. Now, all of you have studied a little bit, and we know that we often think about these three categories of being, and we say, here you have it. On pole number one, in corner number one, you have the angels. What's the quality of an angel? Purely spiritual. On corner number two, you have an animal, and a chamor, a donkey, is chosen. What is chamor also? What are the same letters of chamor? What do they mean? Chomer. Chomer is the Hebrew word for matter, for physicality. A donkey, an animal, doesn't have a divine soul. It's alive, but that's not a soul which is infused into him from above. Only a human being had God blow into his nostrils the breath of life. The animal is organic life. So an animal, a donkey specifically, and every animal, is on the other extreme. Pure physicality. And what's in between? Man. Man has a body which resembles the body of an animal, created on the same day as the animals, in the same batch, but blown into him the spiritual component, the neshama. Man is the monkey in the middle. He's right between the two of them. And what's the struggle of man since the beginning, since the Garden of Eden, since the Tree of Knowledge, and until this very day, is how to manage the conflict, the tension, the competition between body and soul, between what we generally call the evil inclination and the good inclination. But really what that means is we have physical needs, physical drives. Right? This morning, the alarm clock rang at whatever time it rang, right? And our body says, you have about 612 hours of sleep to make up, right? Stay in bed. And the neshama said, you want to daven, you want to learn, get out of bed, right? That's a classic struggle, but it's all the way in every step of our lives. What's going to drive us? Are our bodily needs going to pull us, or are our soul's needs going to pull us? That's what's unique about man. That's why man is the being of bechira, of choice, choosing between the two. Will the physical prevail, or will the spiritual prevail? That's the tension. Says the Talmud, if the first ones were like angels, what would that mean if the first ones were like angels? They weren't angels, they were people. They had the same two eyes, two legs, they had the same stomachs that grumbled like we did. What would it mean if the sages said that the first ones were like angels? Someone. They were spiritually prolific. They were very, very strong. Their spirituality overwhelmed. They were almost like angels in the sense that the guiding force, the motivating power in their lives was their neshama, was their spirit. If we would say that about them and we would look at ourselves relative to them, we would feel like people. In other words, by us, it's far more ambiguous. It's far more ambiguous. As time goes on, we seem to become more and more materialistic. More that what drives us and motivates us are the less sublime things. If the early ones, you'll say, oh, they were people. In other words, you saw in them the spiritual motivations and the physical motivations, and they had to struggle with it too. But then you look at us, and what would you say? We would be like donkeys. It was there the spiritual showed up. But us, we're a step down. So how does that passage in the Talmud illustrate to us what the difference is, the way they're seeing it, between the way the generations perceive things? Is it a matter of how brilliant they are? Is it a matter of intelligence? Because let me ask you something, guys. How many of you, when we first read this passage in the Talmud, and I gave, like, sort of, by the way, a little rejoinder, you said, you know, he's right, I don't really understand this. Knowledge? Hasn't knowledge grown over time? If I have seen farther, is it only because I stood on the shoulders of giants? Right? Who said that? Which member of Chazal? Anyone? You guys are really Amei Oretz. Isaac Newton, right? Isn't that Isaac Newton? Right? Isn't that Isaac Newton? Newton. Yitzchak Newton. okay.
Big fan of his brother Fig.
Right? Knowledge seems to progress. But what's the Talmud speaking about? Are they speaking about, okay, what we know about this science or that science where knowledge progresses? Or is it speaking about the knowledge which is the knowledge of character? The knowledge which is born of the dynamic between the physical and the spiritual, which affects the way we understand things, the way we see things in the world. That is where perhaps we don't make progress, where perhaps we take steps back. Where the Talmud says the earlier generations, they were less entrenched in the physical, and therefore they were able to see things better with their mind's eye than we are, where indeed so much of what influences the way we see things is by our desires, by our interests. The Rambam, in the very beginning of his Moreh Nevuchim, of his Guide for the Perplexed, asks a very simple question. And some of you have heard this from me before. Very, very basic foundational Rambam. The Rambam asks a simple question. He says, Adam is told, one thing you can't do, don't eat from that tree, because that's the tree of knowledge and good and evil. If you eat from that, it's a terrible thing. Says the Rambam, you know what? It sounds like a great thing that a person should gain from there the knowledge of good and evil, which the Rambam understands, the knowledge to distinguish between good and evil. That would seem to be an advancement, not a step back. So the Rambam says, no, it is a step back. Why? Okay. So again, we're going to illustrate this. Okay, back to purple tomato mode. Chocolate ice cream, good or bad?
To me, good.
To you, good. Stealing, good or bad?
Bad.
The world is flat. Good or bad?
Wrong.
Exactly. You don't say good or bad, you say wrong. The world is flat is an objective reality. There's no question. You have any question, go take a look at what they looked at from space, picture space, you see the earth is round. It doesn't begin, you don't say good or bad on the earth is round. Ice cream is good or bad. Why? You're going to say, an objective statement, ice cream, chocolate ice cream is truth, right? I know some people who feel that way, right? but the truth is that chocolate ice cream, good or bad, that's a matter of taste. It's not an objective reality, it's a matter of taste. Al tam v'reach, ein litvakeach, expression in Hebrew. On taste and smell, what you like, your taste, you can't argue, right? You either like it, you don't like it, everybody's different. It's good or bad. Stealing. Is that a matter of taste? Or is that a matter of objectivity? How can you refer to stealing, to lying, to everything else, adultery, as in the same terms that you would talk about chocolate and vanilla ice cream? These things should be spoken of in the kind of terms that you speak about, that the world is flat or the world is round, with absolute clarity. Says the Rambam, before Adam Arishon ate from the tree of knowledge, his knowledge was of truth and falsehood. He saw right and wrong, not as good and bad, as absolute. This is absolutely right, this is absolutely wrong. After he ate from the tree of knowledge, it became subjective. What happened when he ate from the tree of knowledge? He enhanced his physicality. He went after something, the fruit that was attractive, that tasted good. The mind got clouded by the body, and he didn't see things as clearly anymore. Before he ate from the tree of knowledge, he was like an angel. He was detached from the physicality. It didn't drive him. It didn't cloud his judgment. After he ate from it, he was like a human being, where it drove him, and it affected his judgment. And perhaps he was even a little bit like an animal. Or they wanted to make him like an animal, because after all, our sages tell us, and we're just going to drop this and we'll leave it at that, that the snake, which, by the way, when was the last time you heard of a snake talking to a person? The snake wanted to marry Chava. In other words, guys, you can be animals too. You can be Chamorim too. Just go after your physicality. And then it's amazing what happens to the wisdom, not necessarily the wisdom about quarks and about, you know, black holes, right, which can advance over time, but the wisdom about stealing, the wisdom about morality, the wisdom about understanding those truths, those get very, very cloudy very, very quickly when the physical gets stronger and gets more muscular in terms of defining a person. So now let's read our Gemara. The door of the Heichal, the door of the Ulam. The hearts of the first ones were like the door of an Ulam. The hearts of the second ones were like the door of the Heichal. The heart is a very, very physical organ. It is also understood by our sages, and there is, I'm not going to get into the scientific research that backs this up or doesn't back this up, but the heart has always been seen also as the seat of passions, right? You know, when you get excited about something, what goes up? Your heart rate, right? It is going to be affected by this. It's what you desire, it's what you're interested in. And the heart, therefore, is a very, very important place. What you're passionate about, what you're interested in, are you interested in things of the spirit, or are you interested in things of the body, of the physicality? Does your heart rate go up when you're approaching a great shear, or when you pass by a bakery? Right? Guy's getting hungry about now. So, therefore, we speak about this wisdom as in, not in the brain. Right? Just take the brain, you put a little dish, it'll get its wisdom by itself objectively. We're talking about the wisdom that interacts with the passions, with the desires of the person. A door. A door is the connection, the opening between two things. You have the person and you have the wisdom. I want to teach you a little bit of halacha. It happens to be from the very, very same Masechta, from the very same tractate that this Agada is found in. And that's probably not a coincidence that this particular metaphor finds itself in a volume where on the first page they talk about the door of the Ulam and the door of the Heichal. And this is the idea. Everybody knows about an Eruv. On Shabbos, you can't carry, if you're in a wide open public space, you have to have some kind of a wall surrounding the area. Those are the mechitzos. Those are the walls that surround the Eruv. Now, what does that mean, a wall? Does the wall have to be a brick wall that surrounds the place completely? If there's a door in the wall that people can go in and into and come out of, does that mean that you're not surrounded by a wall? Well, of course you're still surrounded by a wall, because it's understood. A house has doors. It has windows. And there's still the house as opposed to outside the house. So as well, you could have it, but you can understand that there's a certain point where something is so wide open that we have to say, you know something, it's compromised. It's not really a wall with a door in it anymore. It's broken through. It's wide open. Right? That makes sense? What is the measure of an opening that can still be considered legitimate, that the wall is still there, but there's an opening to be able to get in? And when does the door become too big that we would say, you know, it's as if there's nothing there. It's as if it's wide open. So the Talmud says, the mainstream opinion of the Mishnah is 10 amos, 10 cubits, which is 15 to 20 feet. Where do we learn it from? We learn it from the door of the Heichal, the door of the temple building. There's another opinion in the Talmud that says, no, it could be bigger than that. Maybe open-ended, or maybe 20 amos. Like the door of the Ulam, of the top of the T. Remember, of that big, big area. But that's not the mainstream opinion. Why? Because that building, which was not as sacred as the Heichal, really didn't have such a close-off, a shelter from the outside. It was wide open. The Heichal, which is the sanctum, the inner sanctum, there, it has to be respectfully surrounded by walls, and its door will be a door, a way to enter. But it's not going to be just wide open. The holier it is, the more it's going to be protected, the more it's going to have walls around it. Says the Maharal, the doorway is how receptive the person, the human being, the body is to wisdom. The early ones, they were like angels, remember? It was like their physicality didn't exist. The door was wide open. Wide open. Like the ulam, where we didn't care so much about keeping it protected. It didn't protect itself. The body didn't have its line in the sand, didn't have its line that you couldn't cross to get in. The body negated itself virtually and was completely, completely open to the wisdom. The hearts of the later generations, there, the body stood more. They were like people, right? There's a body and there's a soul. There is a body and there's the wisdom, which is able to enter. It has a nice doorway where you're able to enter through that doorway and the wisdom is able to come in. But it was a little bit more, where the desires, the normal human desires of a person, were more of a presence. And therefore the wisdom was a little bit more at tension with the cloudy passions that a person would have, and so it became a little bit more complicated. There was a doorway, there was entry, there was possibility, but it wasn't wide open. Our hearts are not even, we don't even have like a regular doorway. We are perhaps a little bit more entrenched. I'm being so gentle. Perhaps a little bit more. That's not what the Talmud says, okay? We are more entrenched in our physicality. We are more entrenched in our desires and our things. Our lives, our materialism is much more developed, much more sophisticated, much more encompassing. Right? Once upon a time, you know, they had to work a little bit, and they were able to bring home the food that they needed. Nowadays, right, to make two car payments on SUVs is a little bit more challenging. We have to work a little bit harder. We work like crazy in order. Right, we're much more entrenched in our materialism. And therefore, the wisdom doesn't even have a regular doorway. A regular doorway doesn't have to be 10 amos wide. A regular doorway has to be 4 tfachim, 4 fist breadths wide, to be considered a proper doorway. This is like the eye of a needle. It's a struggle. The objectivity of wisdom is a struggle to be able to gain. Again, not because science hasn't moved forward, but because this wisdom, the wisdom which is affected by the nexus, by the connection between our desires and our minds, that is more challenging, more complicated. The Gemara isn't finished. The other one says, he says, Anan, we kisichsa beguda le Gemara. For learned information, Gemara is learned information. Gemara is used usually, especially in the context of this Gemara, where it's contrasted with Svara. Gemara is something which is handed over from one generation to the other. Even a piece of wisdom, a received piece of wisdom, for us to get it, also, in other words, even if somebody will tell us something, it's sometimes an effort to gain it. Forget gleaning something on our own, where it requires this whole process. But to learn something from somebody else, it also requires, like getting a nail into a wall, it requires to be forced in there a little bit. And the other one says, it's like a finger in wax for Svara. Explains the Maral. Logic. There are things which are learned, and there's then things which we think about, which we contemplate and try to discover on our own. If you take a nail and you hammer it into the wall, and then you go like this to the nail, what's going to happen? Absolutely nothing. It'll be stuck in the wall. Your nail goes into the wall, it goes in firmly. If it didn't go in firmly, it's because of chmeitz, whatever, you did it into a drywall or something like that that's crumbly, it's not hard. But you put it into a beam, the nail sticks. If you put your finger into wax, what happens? It wiggles, right? You push it in, it wiggles around. Our svara, our logic, is not rock solid. It's not firm. We can say something, I'll argue with you a point, and I'll say, this is the way it's supposed to be. But the truth is, there's wiggle room. It could be this way, and it could be that way. Our knowledge isn't going to be so sharp. It's not truth and falsehood. It's not the world is flat, the world is round. It could be this way, and it could be that way. And the closing statement, that even when we learn something for forgetfulness, it's easy, it comes right out. It's because of this difficulty. Really, if we have time, I don't like to overstay, even if we're having a great time together, but I want to make sure that we try to stick pretty much to the hour. But shikha, forgetfulness, is something which, again, is seen as a regular feature in the Talmud. In the sage's analysis, we forget things that we have a hard time integrating. Why do we have a hard time integrating them? Because somehow, you know, it goes a little bit against our nature, right? It's easy to get something to stick when it's welcomed, when it's a natural fit. The whole idea over here in the Gemara is that difficulty. Our sages have a tradition that when did Shikha, when did the Jewish people start forgetting what they learned? When they did the golden calf and the first luchos, the first tablets were broken. Right? Why? Because that was a remake of the sin of the golden, of the sin of eating from the tree of knowledge. The Jewish people at Sinai were so pure, so spiritual, they were like angels. They used the words of angels, we will do and we will hear, that's the words of angels. But then they went back and they said, we're human beings. You know, human beings can't interact with God. We're beings of flesh and blood. They were more focused on the reality of their physicality than their spirituality. That's when they started to forget. That's when the lessons of Torah became less part of the fabric of their being. So therefore, easy in, easy out, or hard in, easy out. This is how the Talmud is describing it. So we start off today with a passage of the Talmud that says, compared to the early generations, we are a bunch of imbeciles. Right? And they say, okay, it's very, very nice. Nice to say that. We feel very good about ourselves. And on top of that, we don't really understand it so well, because we know that in so many realms of knowledge, we are light years ahead of where they were in the time of the Talmud. So first of all, it seems a little simple. Second of all, it seems a little wrong. Now we understand, with the help of the Maral, that no, we're talking here about the kind of knowledge which, again, is not just, you know, objective knowledge. It's the kind of knowledge of understanding, of the wisdom of Torah, like the stealing, the morality, that kind of thing which can be colored and influenced by our feelings, by our desires, by what it would say to us, what would be the consequences of this learning. And in that, the early ones, because they were less entrenched in the physical part of their being, they were more open to it. They welcomed it more, and therefore they had a greater clarity than we do. And we've had, you know, seeing the subtleties of how the Talmud expresses itself, to be able to understand how the Talmud is talking about this dynamic of mind and body. So it's a window into the richness of what this simple statement of Chazal is. To conclude with just the point of the Maral, and perhaps that this illustration helps us see, so he says, so indeed, when the sages say things, before we reject them and their consequences, we would do best to treat them as the great sages, as the wise people who they are, and to work hard to understand, to plumb the depths of what it is that they're saying, because that is the most rewarding of exercises. It gives you the great estimation, esteem for Chazal that we truly need to have, and it grants us a wisdom in ourselves that sometimes seems very, very elusive. Questions? Anna?
Very good. Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you, Randall.
Thank you. Yeah. You're welcome to keeping. Welcome to leaving.
As you wish. Huh? Next week we're going to go on. We finished our. This is what we're going to do. That's the introduction. Next week we will progress to.